This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 253 was recorded on January 7th, 2021. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Masterworks.io, bringing fine art investing within reach of all investors. Regular listeners have heard me say it 100 times. If the declines in U.S. crude oil production that Art Berman has predicted are actually realized, we could be looking at a moonshot in oil prices before 2021 is over. But where do we stand with respect to those predictions, considering the fact that Art Berman originally thought the decline would have begun by now, which it clearly hasn't, per EIA data? Petroleum geologist Art Berman returns as this week's feature interview guest to answer that question and many more. We'll discuss the coming domestic production decline, which Art Berman still predicts, when it will happen, as well as this week's OPEC Plus meeting and much more. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when Patrick's chart book addresses the question, can 2021 be even crazier than 2020?
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, we usually use this market wrap segment to cover the past week's developments in the markets and what we see on the near-term horizon. But for our first show of the year, our tradition is to take a step back and talk about the longer-term outlook for each of those five macro asset classes. So let's start off with the equity markets, which basically are at all-time highs in the middle of this pandemic. Eric, what's your thinking here on stock prices and where we're heading here in 2021?
I think we're looking at one of two possible scenarios. Number one is the possibility that we're at the late stages, that parabolic, euphoria stage of a late stage bear market where we're getting close to the final blow off top and everything reverses and heads downhill from there. Jeremy Grantham, a very famous stock market analyst, published an article this week saying essentially that. That article is linked in your research roundup. So if you want that perspective of why this might be a very late stage bull market coming to its end, that perspective is in the research roundup. The other possibility, though, and frankly, I'm starting to think it's more likely, is what Ludwig von Mises called a crack-up boom. The scenario where as governments just go crazy with printing more and more money, that money has to go to someplace, and where it ends up going is into asset prices, causing everything from real estate to stocks to commodities, and eventually the goods in the inflation basket, you know, the cost of gasoline and bread and butter and so forth, all goes up. So the crash in that scenario comes in the form of a crash in real purchasing value of the currency. You never see a crash in nominal stock prices. And I think that may be the situation that we're in. I don't know which it is. It could be either one of those two scenarios. But frankly, the former is no longer my base case. I'm kind of leaning toward the latter scenario. What I can say with confidence is the market is not rallying because we've got a healthy, strong economy. Look, if we had a healthy, strong economy, short-term interest rates would be somewhere between 5 and 10%. We have short-term interest rates somewhere between 5 and 10 basis points. That is not a healthy economy. So the question is, are we coming into the end, blow-off top kind of end of a late-cycle bull market? Or is this really just the beginning of a crack-up boom that eventually ends in a debasement of the currency and a loss of purchasing power? I'm leaning toward the latter, but hey, there's famous people like Jeremy Grantham calling for the former. So you got to consider both possibilities.
All right. Well, let's move on to the U.S. dollar index, because 2020 can be summarized now as about a 10% decline from the top to bottom throughout the year. And we find ourselves now trading very close to the bottom of that range. What's your thinking for the dollar here in 2021?
Well, interestingly, you said two different things there. You first said the dollar index, and then you said, what's your thinking for the dollar? let's really focus on the dollar. The part that I have extreme conviction about, very strong conviction, is the U.S. dollar will lose real purchasing value over the next several years as governments around the world continue to create more money out of thin air, debase the value of fiat currency. It's really the only viable choice at this point. We've backed ourselves into a corner where governments don't have any choice but to do that, as we discussed in our year-end special with Ronnie Sterfley and Grant Williams. So I think we're eventually getting to, you know, heading toward the day where a loaf of bread costs $20. Now, the dollar index is another question entirely. That's a relative comparison of the value of the dollar to other fiat currencies. Look, don't underestimate Christine Lagarde's ability to print with reckless abandon. You know, it's not just the United States Federal Reserve that can play this game. So I don't know. I don't really have any strong conviction about the long term, where's the dollar headed relative to other currencies, because we're in a competitive devaluation situation where other central banks are going to be devaluing their currencies as well. The part that I have strong conviction about is the U.S. dollar loses real purchasing value going forward. At some point, we need to get Luke Grohman back on the show, because I'd love to talk to him about this distinction between the dollar versus the dollar index and which one is really headed south from here. I say it's the dollar, not necessarily the dollar index.
All right. Well, let's move on to crude oil, because we just had the OPEC meetings and we have Art Berman on the show. But what's your kind of bigger take here as the oil seems to be edging to a fresh high here?
Well, we are edging to a fresh high. And, you know, boy, we've almost completely retraced the COVID-19 sell-off. I think we're going to get to $65 to $75, and I'd say more likely $75 by the end of 2021, if, number one, Art is right about a significant decline in U.S. production, and two, if we stay on present course and speed approximately in terms of recovering from the pandemic. In other words, if the vaccines mostly work, I think there's very clear we're going to have some mutations and some complications and so forth. But if we continue to see progress being made toward reopening the economy, eventually getting global air travel, you know, flying again by the end of the year, I think you see at least $75 on WTI front month futures before the year is out. Certainly, if you had a major complication in the pandemic and everything was shut down again, that could change it. And likewise, if Art is wrong about the production decline, that would change my outlook as well. The thing is, we're already overdue for a technical pullback of some kind. I was targeting $52 to $55 as high as I thought we could possibly go on this move before there was a significant pullback of $8 to $10. Well, we're already almost at 52 as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon. So, you know, we're really pushing it, but I think what's coming in terms of a pullback will be fairly short-lived, because as much as I do think there's going to be some mutation complications for the virus, I also think that the reflation dynamic is going to be more important than just normal supply and demand inputs to oil prices, and I think ultimately prices of all commodities, including oil, are headed much higher. We'll save the rest of the fundamentals for Art, but I want to quickly just cover inventory, because we're not going to discuss that with Art. Crude oil drawing down 8 million barrels. That's a really big drawdown. Of course, normally that big 8 million barrel drawdown would be a super bullish signal for prices. The thing is, it was offset by really big builds in finished products. Gasoline building 4.5 million barrels, distillates building 6.4 million barrels. So between them, more than 10 million barrels of finished product builds offsetting 8 million barrels of drawdown on crude oil. Cushing, Oklahoma building 792,000 barrels. Overall, that still led to higher prices despite the big finished product builds. And the rally really looks like it just wants to continue indefinitely. I don't think it can continue indefinitely. We've come up so far so fast. I would expect that this runs out of steam somewhere between $52 and $55. And at that point, I think we're due for a technical correction of $8 to $10, but probably not for long. And eventually, we start pushing north towards $65, but not until we start to see the beginnings of this production decline that Art has talked about. And let's save the rest of the discussion about where that's headed for the feature interview with Art Berman.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because gold was started the year in a very strong bull impulse, but the last half of the year, we saw gold giving back a chunk of its gains and consolidating. And then here at the start of the year, looks like we got a fresh breakout up until yesterday. And the question is this a breakout for real? What's your take on gold in the much bigger picture, and what's in store for us in 2021?
Well, in the much bigger picture, I think we get to a minimum of $5,000 per ounce on gold before 2030. And that sounds like a really big number, but really that number of years on an annual percentage basis, that's not that big of a number. I think we do get at least that high by 2030. And I would say probably we get to 2,300 on the current run sometime in 2021. Then there's a cyclical pullback. Of course, there normally always is. I still think that Bitcoin is taking scarcity trade market share away from gold. Now, at some point last year, I think we were actually seeing significant downward price pressure. Price of gold goes down substantially because Bitcoin is stealing the market share. That seems to have played out fully. At this point, I think what's going on is the rally that should be occurring in gold because of all the stimulus expectations is being suppressed. Gold is rallying, but only a little bit as Bitcoin skyrockets, as more and more younger investors are turning to Bitcoin as their favored scarcity asset rather than gold. Now, I predicted here on Macro Voices before the holiday that if Bitcoin broke out past its previous all-time highs, I thought it was a setup for it to accelerate very quickly to the upside. Well, it's up more than 100% since I said that less than a month ago, so I guess that call was right. I think Bitcoin eventually is headed toward a blow-off top, just like 2017, where it just goes crazy up until eventually it runs out of steam, and then it goes crazy down hard. But that probably doesn't happen until much higher numbers. Could that number be 100,000? Sure, anything's possible. When it eventually blows off, that would probably be a catalyst once it's clear that it really was a blow-off top and Bitcoin prices are collapsing. That's the point where I think it becomes a catalyst to push gold very quickly up to what might become a cyclical high, let's say up to 2,300 or whatever the number is. Is there then another cycle, like a seesaw between gold and Bitcoin, where gold continues to really go up as Bitcoin crashes from that blow-off top, and that sets up another cycle where eventually gold's rally is suppressed as Bitcoin starts another leg higher? I'm not sure, but it certainly seems like so far that's kind of been the pattern that we're seeing. We'll do a show on Bitcoin and where it's headed at some point this month in January. You know, the momentum has been huge here, and there definitely was an asymmetric trade entry opportunity on that breakout from the previous all-time high for people who are good at momentum trading. Now, I don't for an instant believe that it's because there's any real intrinsic value to Bitcoin. It's the same kind of mania that you saw in the South Seas bubble or that you saw in the late 90s tech stock bubble. But the momentum is there, and if you know how to play it, you can certainly make money on it. The thing is, we're already up 100% from when we talked about that setup last month, so it's a little bit late for that entry. But there will be more entries, and you know, even though that one is no longer ripe, I do think eventually there's probably more upside in Bitcoin before this crazy mania blows off. And I do think it's a crazy mania. Very, very similar to the late 90s dot-com boom. But frankly, if you go back to that late 90s dot-com boom, what needed to be understood that for some reason Wall Street guys just couldn't understand was pretty darn simple stuff. E-commerce and websites were going to be a major part of the future, but no, that didn't mean that pets.com was a good idea. They couldn't seem to distinguish, and they would just pay through the nose for anything with .com in its name. Frankly, really understanding the coming digital currency revolution and the reasons that Bitcoin is not likely to be the ultimate winner in the contest for the dominant digital currency system, something I wrote a book about back in 2018, that's much more complex. So it stands to reason if they couldn't understand fairly simple stuff back in the late 90s, it's going to be an even longer amount of time before they come to understand more complex subjects like what's going to happen with digital currency. So it's going to be a really interesting ride. We'll do a show about it this month, but I think that if you're playing this, understand that it's a speculative mania, and as long as you understand that you're making a momentum trade and it's eventually going to reverse and go the other way, hey, if you can make money on it, that's great. Just remember, anything that can go up 100% in a month can go down 50% in a month just as easily.
All right, Eric, let's wrap things up here with talking about that 10-year Treasury yield. Obviously, bonds have been very quiet for a while, but we are getting a little bit of action. I want to talk about it in the postgame a little bit, but what's your bigger picture outlook here on the 10-year yield?
You know, honestly, I think the big picture is from a trader's perspective, there really is no tradable picture that I see. Interest rates are already super duper low, so there's no trade to be had by betting on them moving lower. They can't, frankly, be allowed to rise very much because it would cripple the economy and bankrupt the U.S. government. So I don't think there's any big trade to be made on betting that they go substantially higher either. You know, the fact of the matter is we're at a moment in history just this week where the big news being discussed in the financial media is that the 10-year Treasury is moved up to this massively large number of 1%. You know, just a few years ago, people would laugh at you if you said it was possible for it to ever go as low as 1%. Now we're talking about that as if it's a big number. I think we're stuck with super low yields for many years to come. So if you want to say what's the trading opportunity, I don't think it's on a move in yields directly. I think it's rather what are the second order derivative effects of being stuck at low yields. It's inflation or stagflation. What does that mean? You know, it probably means commodity prices are set to rise very dramatically. You know, that's where the trades are. It's not in the 10-year yield itself.
This week's feature interview guest is petroleum geologist Art Berman. Now, Eric, why did we get Art back on the show to start the year?
Well, Patrick, as our regular listeners know, I have been very interested in Art's forecast of a very sharp decline in U.S. production. Originally, Art thought that was going to have happened last quarter. He told us at the beginning of last quarter that it might get pushed out into Q1. I want to see where Art stands and whether he still holds that view, because if he's right about that, where we've already got a lot of macroeconomic effects that are pressing all commodity prices, including oil, higher, if we really get into a major decline in U.S. production, that could create a moonshot scenario by the end of the year for oil prices. So I'm really anxious to get an update on this from Art.
Eric's interview with Art Berman is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Abex Technologies, which also sponsors my new Smarter Markets podcast, which airs every Saturday morning and explores how markets themselves could be redesigned to better serve market participants and society as a whole. My interview with Logica Fund CIO Mike Green last Saturday is getting rave reviews, so be sure to check it out on Smarter Markets if you haven't yet. Macro Voices listeners remember Kyle Bass telling us just before the holiday that Singapore is heir apparent as the new Asian financial center. So this coming weekend, my guest on Smarter Markets will be Frank Lavin, former U.S. ambassador to Singapore. We'll take a deep dive on the country's history, its suitability to replace Hong Kong as Asia's primary financial center, and Frank's assessment of MAS, the Singaporean equivalent of the SEC. But you won't get Smarter Markets episodes on your Macro Voices feed. You have to subscribe separately to Smarter Markets in your podcast app to receive this exciting free podcast.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is petroleum geologist Art Berman. For anyone who doesn't know, Art is famous for his graphs and charts, so you're going to want to be sure to download the chart deck that accompanies today's interview. You'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you're not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, look for the red button above Art's picture that says "Looking for the Downloads." Art, our regular listeners know that I'm dying to ask you about the production decline that you have been predicting. But before we even get to that, I want to start with this week's OPEC Plus meeting, when Saudi Arabia surprised a lot of people by essentially resolving a deadlock where they couldn't agree on what to do about production cuts, and Saudi Arabia kind of volunteered to go it alone and unilaterally cut on their side in order to allow other OPEC Plus countries not to have to cut. What's going on there? What do you make of this? What brought that about, and what do you make of this meeting in general?
Eric, of course, I'm speculating, but my sense of this is that we're looking at, you know, classic game theory, that OPEC Plus has been trying to manage the world's largest commodity, the most largest, world's largest traded commodity now for, you know, pretty nearly 5 years, and that just can't be done. And so they've reached a point now where Russia doesn't really feel like doing this much anymore. And honestly, I don't think Saudi Arabia does either. But they tried a different path back in March with catastrophic results. And so that's not really where they want to go. So the, you know, what the prisoner's dilemma says is that as long as nobody changes their stratagem, we just continue doing whatever we were doing. And I think Saudi Arabia is now saying, okay, we're in control here, and this is what we're doing. And they're basically saying, we can't afford another catastrophe, and we're tired of cajoling. Last time around, we threatened you guys with, you know, flooding the market, and this time around, we're saying, you know, give it a break. Well, we've got this under control. And after all, Saudi Arabia has been they've really been OPEC all along. So leading into where you and I want to go with this conversation, the real question is it necessary? And there's no question that the prime motivation is that Saudi Arabia and many others see demand for oil as being lower, perhaps much lower than expected just a month ago or so. And so they're, you know, kind of taking preventative, preemptive action right now to cut supply. Where I think, I mean, I'm certainly happy that they're doing that if they want to, although it hasn't worked very well for the last 4 or 5 years. But I also believe that they're probably following EIA's forecast for U.S. production, and I'm more painfully aware than almost anyone of you know, how wrong even my forecasts can be. So not saying anything about it, but if EIA says that U.S. is going to produce 11 million barrels a day for the rest of 21, and it's only 10, well, maybe Saudi Arabia didn't need to do what it did. That's, you know, that's kind of where I'll leave it for now.
I see this as very significant, Art, because a lot of Western analysts who, frankly, have been second-guessing all along, we don't really know what the mindset of the Saudis has been, but a lot of people were saying, look, what's going to happen here is the Saudis are not going to let oil prices get back up to the level where you could have a restart of the U.S. shale boom. They don't want oil prices to recover back to $75 because then U.S. shale would take off again. It seems like they're not worried about that. So what I'm trying to figure out is that because Saudi Arabia is no longer concerned about not wanting to see the U.S. shale industry recover and you know, become its former self? Or is it more the case that they've decided that the U.S. shale industry is so badly damaged that it can't recover, even if they do allow prices to recover substantially, let's say back up to $60 or $70? What do you make of this in terms of what it means for the U.S. shale industry's ability to recover or maybe not have the big decline in production that you and other people have predicted?
That's a great observation, Eric, and obviously we don't know, but a couple of things come to mind. The first is that whatever happens or doesn't happen to the U.S. shale industry, the price of oil, the amount of capital available to the U.S. shale industry, that's all way into the future. If, you know, if tomorrow everybody in the shale industry decided, okay, we're gonna hire as many rigs as possible it wouldn't make any difference to production for pretty nearly a year. So surely Saudi Arabia understands that. The second thing, though, I guess that is the more salient factor is that without other people's money, nothing's going to happen. And certainly the overwhelming sentiment in world markets is that oil is pretty nearly uninvestable, to use somebody's terrible phrase. But I mean, the money has clearly fled far away from E&P and particularly U.S. shale. And so perhaps the Saudis are saying, geez, you know, I mean, even if price gets to 60 or higher, there's so much inertia or negative momentum by investors that the money is just not going to flow back to the shale players anywhere near quick enough to make a difference. What do you think about that?
Well, Art, the thing that strikes me is that we're seeing so much easy money policy and so much continued printing of money that on one hand, I agree with you that you know, oil is kind of out now. And also, there's an extra headwind, which is not only is it kind of out because it's hard to make money on that, but it's also very much out from an ESG perspective. A lot of people think that investing in fossil fuels is irresponsible if you're a responsible ESG investor. I don't agree with that mentality, but a lot of people feel that way, and that's going to hurt the amount of capital that's available. The other side of that argument, though, is there's a heck of a lot of capital that's going to be available for a heck of a lot of things as we get into this MMT world with central banks just printing money like it's going out of style. So I don't know how to reconcile that one, but the one thing that this OPEC meeting definitely speaks volumes to me is the Saudis aren't worried about it. They're not concerned about allowing the price to come up to a level where it could allow the U.S. shale industry to recover. Maybe that's because they think it can't recover. Maybe it's because they don't care if it does recover. I'm not sure which, but it's clear to me that they're not concerned about it. Why don't we go ahead and jump into your slide deck? Starting on page 2, you're talking about the expected decline in demand, which you believe is maybe the reason that Saudi Arabia took this action in this week's meeting.
So let me say, first of all, that analysts, journalists, producers are just absolutely obsessed with demand. And frankly, while I appreciate that, I honestly don't understand it, because oil markets don't run on demand. They run on supply. And there's a simple reason for that, and that is that markets can't do anything about demand, but they sure can about supply by changing the price. And so my perspective after looking at these things for a few decades is that as long as supply adjusts to demand, demand is not the problem. The bigger problem is when demand, which moves very slowly, increases and supply lags behind it as much as it does in the modern world, then you end up with a supply shortage. But in any event, this slide number 2 shows OPEC's supply and demand forecast, demand in orange, supply in green, and then the supply-demand deficit below it in either blue for positive and red for negative. And what it shows is that the supply-demand balance going into 2021 was not too bad. It's about balanced, but it increases to 1.38 or so by the third quarter. And so you'd say, well, you know, that's not too much. Well, that's certainly enough to put things into pretty bad money territory. Now, I think what they're doing is they're saying, wow, we were, you know, really probably overly aggressive on the demand side. And instead of believing that we're going to have, 95 or 94 million barrels per day of demand in the first half of 2021, we're thinking now it's probably going to be more like 91 or 92. And so that changes everything. That says that your supply-demand balance, instead of being you know, 1.3 or 1.4 is now, you know, going to be 2.5 or 3, which is about what it was when oil prices collapsed way back in 2014-15. So that's my sense. Now, I haven't worked out those numbers precisely, but you get the general direction of them.
Art, let's move on to slide 3. Longtime listeners immediately recognize this chart as the comparative inventory yield curve. Just for the benefit of any new listeners we may have, if you don't know about this comparative inventory system, which is kind of Art's trademark, be sure to go back to some of Art's earliest interviews on Macro Voices. Just put Art Berman in the search box at macrovoices.com. And this system of comparative inventory analysis is explained fully in some of those early interviews. What do we see in the comparative inventory yield curve here on page 3?
Eric, what we see is that everything is behaving just exactly as it should. It's behaving as I forecast that it would way back in April or May when WTI weekly price was, you know, $5 or so. I'm showing $3.32 was the lowest that it got for the week in late April. But way back when, I had pretty much the same green yield curve drawn in here. And I was saying, you know, at these levels of surplus, I think WTI is going to work its way back up to, you know, 41 or 42 or 43. And that's pretty much exactly what it did. It dropped down a bit, sort of, you know, about halfway through there, the green dots or the green circles are what we're following, sort of underpriced for a while because of concerns about COVID, over near where it says January 1st to the right of that, started climbing back up just about as soon as vaccines were announced and made its way back to the yield curve a couple of weeks ago. And the yellow dot is from today. I see I've got an extra digit in 47.48, but you know that's. I think you understand that. We're plotting right exactly where it should be. So, the implications of this are that all things being equal, prices aren't going to get to $60. That we're going to draw down stocks in the world as we have been now for months and months and months. And at the 5-year average, which is the y-axis, will, you know, be at about $49 or, you know, $50 WTI. Now, the other thing that I have to say, though, is, yeah, but what about excursions? I mean, we've just been on the biggest yield curve excursion in the history of man. And so that works the other way, too. And there are, you know, examples circled on this graph that show precisely that. So the more concern the market has about supply, the higher above or the larger the excursion above the yield curve we might get. So, you know, if oil price goes to $55 or $60, somebody's sure to say, oh, Art, you were wrong. And I say, well, no, that's what price discovery is about. That's the way the market works. So the message from this chart, Eric, is everything is A-okay. It's just exactly as it should be.
Well, it's exactly as it should be now, but let's talk about where it's headed and move on to slide 4, because what I think about is you've been talking about a very significant decline in U.S. oil production, which hasn't started yet. But if that is to occur the way that you've projected, presumably that means instead of this great big huge oversupply, we're going to have negative comparative inventory at some point. So is that on the radar? And if so, how far out is it? And what is that going to mean?
Absolutely. And it's not very far out at all. So this graph in slide number 4 is U.S. comparative inventory. And I will anticipate all of the smart people, many of them not from the United States, that say, oh, well, that's a very parochial thing to look at. And I do look at, you know, at OECD and everything else too. But my experience is that U.S. storage reporting has the highest frequency. It's weekly as opposed to monthly, and it's got the most accuracy for whatever reason. And it's a darn good proxy. So if anybody's worried that U.S. comparative inventory is somehow skewed from world comparative inventory, it hasn't happened so far. So leave it there. But looking at this graph, what it says to me is at the current decline rate in comparative inventory, which is now pretty nearly 5 million barrels per week, we will be at the 5-year average in a matter of 6 weeks. Now, you know, that changes a little each week as we get a bigger draw or a bigger ad, but it's been marching in that direction ever since mid-July. And back to your original comment, we don't have a great big oversupply right now, not in the United States and not in the world. We are fast approaching the five-year average. We're only 30 million barrels above it as of today. We were five times that a couple of months ago in mid-June. So will we get there, barring some, you know, totally external event that I can't predict? Absolutely. Will we get into negative comparative inventory? I don't see how it's possible we won't.
Now, I want to ask a question about what this reflects, because as I understand it, this positive comparative inventory that we're showing here, this has to do with the reported numbers coming out of EIA inventory reports, which does not include floating storage. During the crisis, when there was no storage available, a bunch of people were chartering tanker ships and filling them up with oil and using them as great big floating gas tanks. Has that oil been delivered back into the market, or do we have, you know, a stealth oversupply that doesn't show up in these charts, but there's actually still a bunch of ships that are full of oil someplace?
Right. Well, so the way that this works, and it's a really excellent question, and nobody really knows the answer to it, but the way that all this works is that it starts with production. Okay, so this is storage, but EIA has a very good, I believe, understanding of how much oil is produced. And that comes from the states, and they have a very good understanding of it because they get tax revenues from it. So it may not be 100% accurate this week, or, you know, might take several weeks or even a few months to get it all, you know, properly balanced, but they want their tax money, so they're going to get it right. And so there's production, which we know. There's oil that flows into the pipes, which we know. I mean, as far as I know, nobody is able to go from the wellhead to an offshore tanker. They've got to put it in a pipe. They've got to send it somewhere, whether that be to Cushing, Oklahoma, or to the coast to put on a tanker. And so we know what's produced, and we know its disposition. Okay, we know how much goes into the flow, and then we know how much ends up in official storage. And so the numbers are massaged a little bit to include all of that. And that's where we get this thing called unaccounted for oil. Unaccounted for oil is oil that EIA knows to be there because it was produced, but it hasn't shown up in the flow. So the answer to your question is, if that floating storage originated from a well in the United States, it is accounted for. Whether or not it shows up in the storage number or not, it is known. And so my sense is that I'm not disputing that it's there. I'm just saying that it wasn't a big factor, as far as I can tell, back in 2015, 16, 17. It has not been a big factor yet. So I'm not losing sleep over it. I acknowledge it, but I don't know.
Moving on to slide 5, you're moving now into U.S. consumption recovery. You know, this is something I think about a lot, because it seems to me that on one hand, even though there might be more mutations of the virus and more complications and more issues with the pandemic, it seems that society has become extremely intolerant of lockdowns. And if we have more lockdowns, they'll be minimum in duration, and we'll continue to operate as much of the economy as we can, despite the situation with the virus. So in many ways, it feels to me like we're going to, you know, get back to normal consumption. But I do think international air travel will probably stay very, very subdued for a while to come. How much of the consumption does aviation fuel account for? And, you know, if we have everything come back except for aviation, what would that look like in terms of a recovery for demand?
Right. It's roughly 6%. Okay. So if the world produced 100 million barrels a day, 6 million of that is for air travel. So it's a significant number for sure, but it's not that big of a percentage. And especially within the context of the kind of reductions that we've seen. And so if you look at the graph in slide number 5 and you look at kerosene jet, which is the second 3 columns toward the right, you see that its recovery is 57%. And for background, that number until just a few weeks ago was half that. So the recovery was, you know, actually for a while it was below 20%. It, you know, it rattled around 20-25 for a while. And so contrary to public belief or opinion, I see this number coming up just about every week. 57% is terrible compared to 100, but it's more than double what it was not very many weeks ago. So based on consumption, based on what comes out of U.S. refineries, I see kerosene jet recovering. It'll lag behind everything else. The one that I worry about more than anything else is gasoline. And I would have thought many, many months ago when, you know, you and I first started talking about COVID and what its effect on demand might be, I would have thought that gasoline would be the first to come back. You know, people get really tired of sitting around at home and they're going to go out and drive their cars, even if they got nowhere to go. And at first that seemed to be what was happening. But what I've seen now since, two, 3 months ago, gasoline consumption recovered to about 84-85% of, and when I say recovery, I mean between the minimum and the 5-year average. We can talk about that a little bit more later if you like, but that's the way I define recovery. And so what I've seen, though, is it's actually been dropping, or it's staying below the maximum that it reached. And so to me, in the past, I always used to say, oh, well, diesel is the, you know, that's the real barometer of the U.S. economy. And the way this crazy pandemic has worked, I guess we're all ordering so many packages from Amazon and you name it, that, I mean, diesel is 134% of recovery right now. So it's above the 5-year average, and it's been higher in recent weeks with the holidays and whatnot. So if gasoline remains stalled at, let's just say, 80%, that's telling me something about U.S. mobility. That it just isn't what it was for whatever reason. And that is a huge volume. I mean, that is, you know, gasoline is like, you know, 40% of the barrel. So it's, you know, it's a big number.
Now, it's hard to put any hard numbers in this, Art, but it seems to me like a trend that a lot of people are talking about is, hey, we've learned how to work from home with this pandemic, and, you know, we don't need to go back to work. We can save money on office space. So clearly, the gasoline has to do with personal vehicle transportation. So does it ever go back to 100%, or do we decide not to drive to work as much because we can work from home?
No one knows, but I can't imagine that we're ever going to all go back to the way we were, because we found that it's not necessary. And more importantly, the companies that most people work for, why should they spend so much money on commercial office space when they only need half of it or a third of it? The other factor, though, Eric, is gasoline is the most elastic of all of these numbers, that we're really seeing in gasoline consumption, a reflection of discretionary spending. There are just limits to how much the economy can function without something like diesel or propane or some of the others on there. But gasoline is something where if an American family is hurting, you know, hasn't worked for a while or is only working part-time, even though gasoline prices are dirt cheap right now, that's a place where they can conserve. So I think there's some kind of a balance. I think that so many of the analysts and journalists who look at these things are reasonably well off. I mean, they at least have jobs, and they tend to forget that there are 30-40 million Americans who just don't have enough money to put food on the table regularly, and they're going to watch their spending, and if they don't need to drive somewhere, they won't.
Art, let's move on to the headline event. When we had you on the show back last June, you first told us that you were predicting that probably by the end of 2020, we'd be seeing the beginning of a decline in U.S. production. And it was, since you anticipated that might begin in Q4, it was no coincidence that it was the very first day of Q4 that we had you back on. And at that point, you said, still have the same outlook, but it probably will slip into Q1 of 2021. It is no accident that you're back on Macro Voices on the very first show of 2021. Is the outlook still the same? Does it start in Q1? What kind of decline? Because, I saw some Twitter interactions between you and people that were talking about 5.5 million barrels. That would be half of what we're producing now. That seems impossible to me. So what is the prediction, and is it still on, and when does it happen?
Well, it's happening right now, Eric. You know, we'll move on and look at the slides, but everybody thinks that the U.S. is producing 11 or 11.3 million barrels a day because that's what EIA says in their STEO, their short-term energy outlook reports. You know, I caution people that that's an estimate. It's an estimate based on God knows what, but mostly a survey of producers. And every month when they issue their 914 numbers, which are the gold standard, and it's also lagged back a few months, it's always much lower. So they just released the October numbers, and they're barely above 10 million barrels a day. So we're talking about a decline from the beginning of the year or the end of last year of almost 3 million barrels a day. That's a pretty healthy decline. And so slide six, Eric, my thought experiment, my forecast was wrong. It wasn't notionally wrong. The timing of it was premature. And the main thing that I guess I didn't expect was there were a lot of wells that were shut in April, May, June of 2020. I did not anticipate that they would be reactivated as quickly as they were, nor as many as they were. It was wrong because I based it exclusively on tight oil decline and just used a ratio to extrapolate to U.S. production. And in retrospect, I tied it too rigorously to the rig count decline, which up until this time had worked just perfectly fine, but obviously it didn't going forward. So what I've done differently, which probably I should have done to begin with, hindsight, is I've used all the wells from the four states in the Gulf of Mexico that account for 80% of U.S. production. I've carefully calibrated what production decline would be if we drilled no wells, looked at all the number of producing wells, the rig count, and the drilled uncompleted wells. And the conclusion is that the output decline has begun, but the serious decline will probably not begin until the late in the first quarter or early in the second quarter. The answer, the conclusion is, I've got three cases that I'll show you, and those suggest that we could reach below 8 million barrels a day. It could dip a little bit below 10. Most likely, it'll be somewhere in between.
Art, let's move on to slide seven, where we can see this graphically. What's going on here?
Eric, slide seven is the orange line is exactly what I showed you the last time in, I think it was early October, late September. I've taken off the rig count because I can't fit the scales on with it, but that production curve is exactly what it was then. And what I'm showing in blue is the time shifted U.S. production rate. So we're looking at, you know, one is tight oil, the other is U.S. And what you can see is that up to the present, which is the end of the blue line, the correlation is actually quite good. What you also see is that the divergence between the tight oil and the U.S. production has increased. And that's part of the reason that the forecast was wrong. So that's, you know, just to be fair and honest, you know, that's where we were. This is where we are. But if we move on then to slide eight, this is the full picture. And so slide eight, I'm showing the time shifted U.S. oil directed rig count in blue. and I'm showing production to date up to where it says October 2020. That's the 914 number that I mentioned. And then beyond that are a series of dashed lines. The red is EIA's forecast, which says that we'll be at about 11 million barrels a day forever, with no significant increases or decreases. The next one down is the green. That's the high case of my scenarios, where we'll get below, we'll stay about where we are, maybe go up a little bit, and then go down below 10 million barrels and climb back to 10 and a half by the end of the year. The base case, I think the most likely case, is we drop down to about 9. And the low case, which is, you know, was one of the numbers in the last time around, I still think that's, I say it's not the most likely, but my gut tells me it is, that we'll get below 8 million barrels a day. So that's the answer as I see it right now.
Let's translate this picture into what it means in terms of OPEC's ability to compensate. You get to some level, and it's like, hey, it doesn't matter what OPEC does. They can turn the screws up as high as they want. They still can't make enough oil to make up for the deficit, and we got a real problem. But frankly, until you get to that point, there's probably, for a smaller deficit, it's just, hey, a chance for OPEC to make a little more money. It doesn't really change the supply-demand dynamics that much because they can easily turn up the screws. Where do we get to a sensitivity where it really puts price pressure on because OPEC can't just make up for whatever the U.S. is not producing?
So there's really two answers in your single question. The first is just based on, you know, pure supply and demand. And the answer to that is, I think, as you stated, that it, you know, if we go down to, you know, to 10 million round numbers from 11 million, well, that's what OPEC just said, you know, last night that they're going to cut. So obviously that's there, right? Now, that doesn't last forever, but certainly neither does U.S. production decline, at least according to this view. This view says that, I mean, the rig count has already increased down at the bottom from 178 to 234. I mean, that's in the books. That's not changing. And so as far as this graph goes, short of needing to shut hundreds or thousands of wells in again for reasons of inadequate storage or, you know, disastrously low prices, production will, you know, will reach a bottom and it will have to go back up some. So in the high case scenario, I don't think it's a big deal. In the base case scenario, it's, you know, basically another 750,000 barrels a day, which is a bigger deal. But I also believe that OPEC has the spare capacity to cover that. The low case, you know, now we're getting into some dicey territory, but I think more important is the market perception. And when I was back on the slide number 3, looking at comparative inventory, I spoke about the way that markets use price as a lever to encourage more drilling. And oftentimes, markets will increase price even though there's no imminent supply crunch in the near term, because markets know that with the rig counts being what they are, that the price has to be higher to encourage more drilling. And so my sense, Eric, is that, and I wasn't equivocating, but once U.S. production disappoints the forecast, I think you're going to see price go up pretty aggressively, or the pressure for price to go up, because that's not what the market's expecting.
Now, I agree with that very much, and that's kind of my personal base case, is I think the market's going to be surprised and that much higher prices are likely before 2021 is out. But let me take the opposite side of this and kind of do my journalist job here of playing devil's advocate. Look at how substantially that rig count has turned up. And remember, this is a 13-month lag, so that's going from September to October of 20, not 21, where that actual uptick in the rig count occurred. And hey, I mean, you know, sure, money's a little bit tight these days, but frankly, there's lots of money being printed. What's to say that this rig count doesn't go back up to 900 in the next 3 months?
Because it can't. It doesn't happen that quickly. I mean, if you believe EIA,
it went down that quickly.
Oh, well, it's real easy to let a rig go. You know, you've already got the rig on contract. It's not that easy to get one back again, particularly when they're stacked, which is where they are right now. So there's the physical equipment of the rig, which is stacked, and then there's the crews. You know, these rigs don't run by themselves. I mean, they are far more automated than they were 5 or 10 years ago, but you still need, you know, several dozen people to actually make it happen. And the quality of those people is another issue. I drilled a well with my company and partner back in 2015, late 2015, early 2016. And we had to run off two or three of the crews because they weren't any good. The companies were going out and hiring people who were getting out of prison, for crying out loud, because at least those guys could pass a drug test. They couldn't drill a well worth anything. So there are some substantial lags involved in just getting the rigs out there. And then you've got the frac crews and, you know, all the support, the mud, everything else. You've got to have, you know, you got to be able to bulldoze a location. You got to permit a well. I mean, there's a myriad of things, but EIA says that the lag between a price signal and a rig on location is 4 months. And frankly, I think that's kind of a long time, but that's what they say. All right. And I'm not endorsing their perspective, but it gives you some idea. Is it 4 months? I don't know. I mean, I think I could get a rig in 2 months. I don't think I could get it faster.
Well, let's pretend that you and I are wrong about an inadequacy of investment capital to support this. Let's suppose they can find the money. How quickly could the industry recover the rig count right back up to what's necessary to get us back to, you know, 12 million barrels and, you know, go up from here instead of down?
Right. Well, remember, this is happening. I mean, the production behind it is now out in 2022, right?
Okay.
I mean, this graph ends in December 2021. So the rig count that we have today, the monthly rig count for November of 234, oil-directed rig count, that's already in the books, and we won't see that production until sometime towards the end of this year we're in now. So the lag is what's important, Eric, that you can do all kinds of things. You can get, you know, the government can just say, okay, from now on, the Fed is making available infinite money to the oil and gas industry.
So we can see a recovery of U.S. production in 2022,
yep.
But it's impossible in 2021 is basically what you're saying.
It's impossible beyond what I show on this graph.
Okay. So we're looking at production. It has to come down some. It's a question of how much. Even the EIA says. Now, why does EIA say it only comes down, what do they say, 100,000 barrels or something? Why do they have a flat line here?
That's a really great question, and you should maybe we should ask them. But I respect EIA. I'm not into EIA bashing. None of this that we're talking about, we couldn't have this conversation if it weren't for EIA. They provide me with all this information. However, I don't think there is one geologist or geophysicist who works at EIA. I doubt there's a drilling or completion engineer. These are mostly economists and accountants. None of these guys, and I'm going to be generous here and say I don't know that there's none, but I'm betting that none of these guys has ever drilled a well or been involved with drilling a well. And so they just don't have any idea how this works. And we can argue about why or should they. And frankly, that's irrelevant. They don't. And so what they say is that it takes 2 months from a rig on location to first oil production. And so a lot of what they're doing here is based on that assumption. Now, I've got data that I'll show you a little bit later in these slides. Maybe we can go to that now, which shows that is patently untrue. I mean, it's not my opinion. That's what the numbers tell you. The numbers say that the average time between starting to drill a well and first oil production is 5 months. That's the weighted average for the United States. So EIA thinking it's 2 months is way, way short of what it ought to be just based on data. And I think they're completely delusional, or just they just don't know, in terms of how long does it take once you've got oil coming out of the ground to begin to offset the horrendous declines that are already in progress before you even, you know, staunch the flow and get back to zero. And when you add that in, that's where you get to the 13-month shift.
Art, since you teased the audience, let's jump ahead for a minute to slide 11 and visually look at the lag that exists between getting the rig on site and actually producing and selling oil out of that well.
Slide 11 has a lot of information on it, and let me start with the answer to your question. If you look at the table in the lower left-hand corner of the slide, I have taken these four states and the offshore Gulf of Mexico, which account for 80% of U.S. oil production, and I have used data from Enverus, which comes from the states, as to how many days it takes from beginning of drilling a well to first oil. And I show New Mexico, Oklahoma, North Dakota, federal offshore Gulf, and Texas. I show the number of barrels in 2019 and the average days. And at the very bottom where it says weighted average well start to first oil, it's 140 days. That's the average, the weighted average by production for the United States. So,
and EIA says the number is 60?
Yeah.
Okay. I guess they're wrong.
Well, they're wrong as, you know, yeah, they're wrong in my experience. And honestly, Eric, I mean, again, I'm not criticizing them. The only reason I did this was because I said, wait a minute, that's impossible. I mean, all the things that have to happen from the time you start drilling a well until you get it down, if you're really, really lucky, you know, maybe the average time to get a well down is 30 days. Everything goes perfectly. You've got to log it. You've got to test it. You've got to take the location, the rig off. You got to put a new one on. You got to put pipe in the hole. You have to cement it. You have to wait for the cement to dry. You have to perforate it. You have to frack it. You have to flow the water back. You have to flow test it. You've got to do a whole bunch of stuff. You got to get the state out there to witness the test. And then you got to build a pipeline to get it to the nearest pipeline. If you can do all that in 30 days, I mean, you are smoking, man. I mean, I've talked to a lot of people about this who have done what I have done, and everybody says that's just nuts. You might be able to do it for one well, but that's not an average number, not even close.
Art, I want to come back and talk about the decline rates also on this chart, but first, let's jump back to where we were. So as we look again at slide 8, it makes perfect sense what you're saying. Why could EIA have that flat line where you've got those big dips? Well, obviously, if they're not taking real-world lag times into account in terms of how long it takes to start producing oil after you drill the hole in the ground, obviously, it's going to throw their numbers off. So this makes perfect sense. We see your numbers. Let's move on to slide 9. What does this chart show us?
Well, slide 9 is, again, sort of a calibration. This just shows starkly. This is the 9/14 data. It shows you we are down 2.3 million barrels a day from March. That's the latest data. And this shows you what EIA thinks. EIA thinks that we're not even going to get down again to the level that we were in October. And if you believe anything that I just showed you, you've got to shake your head and say, nah, I don't think so. So that's all that's in this slide. Slide 10 simply shows where the decline in production is coming from. And what you see here is that the biggest declines in absolute numbers, maybe not surprisingly, are the Gulf of Mexico and Texas, where between the two of those, we've lost 2 million barrels a day. Moving back to slide 11, I didn't talk about the actual decline rates, which I will just for a second. In the top center graph, this is actually showing for each one of those five areas and the rest of the United States what the rate of decline is. And it is a breathtaking 42% per year annual decline rate. That shocked me, Eric. I didn't believe that. That is such a big number. If we go on to slide 12, This is the kind of chart you see in, you know, N.O. Peters and, you know, and Rystad and all these kind of guys where they're going to show you the, you know, the every year's production decline and then stack together by year. The graph on the left is 2008 through 2020. And if you go and you measure those things, you will find that the current decline rate or the 2019 decline rate was 43%. Go back to 2014, the last time this happened. The decline rate back then was half. It was 22%. So people are going to go back and they're going to look and say, well, you know, we lost a gazillion rigs between 2014 and 16, and production only dropped a million barrels a day. And I'm going to say two things. First, the decline rate was half what it is today. And second, you're declining from a much smaller base, and therefore you don't need as many wells drilling to support the maintenance. So slide number 13 then puts all of those things, I hope, into perspective. Here we've got the time-shifted rig count going all the way back to 2014 in blue. And we've got the production through, I'm showing a projection into November. And you can see that the correlation between the end of 2016 and recently was quite good. But, you know, you go look then at where it says production on the left, lower left. April 2015, we went from 9.66 down to 8.53. So we only lost 1.1 million barrels a day. So people say, well, why do you think we're going to lose two or three this time around? Well, for all the reasons I showed you. The other thing, of course, you have to take into account is that giant drop in rig count. Most of those that never came back, those were vertical rigs that just, they threw them away. Okay. Those were outdated. They were never used again. So this is not like 2013 and 14. I guess nothing is ever quite like something in the past, but there are good reasons, data-driven reasons, to understand why the production should drop more today than it did then. And then, you know, really the last slide I want to say anything about is number 14. And this does the exact same thing as those previous graphs, the stacked vintaged production declines, except this shows the number of rigs. I'm sorry, the number of producing wells, not the number of rigs. Same data, same four states plus Gulf of Mexico. And what you see here is that the number of active wells in the U.S. has fallen by 34,000 and a little bit since August of 2019. That's a 12% drop in active wells. The last time we had a price collapse, it fell by 8,800, which was only 3%. So what's going on right now is it's a level higher than anything we've seen before. And if you analyze and think about this chart, what you'll understand is that most of those retired wells are the older wells. They're the blue ones. They're the previous years, which is to say before 2014, but that's a big part of the production base. So these are all the reasons that I think that it's reasonable to expect a bigger drop than EIA's 11 million barrels a day, and why it's reasonable that you can choose one of my cases, whichever the one you think is more reasonable.
Art, now I want to go back to our earlier conversation about price and the comparative inventory yield curve that we discussed all the way back on page number 3. And what you said at that point was based on where we are in the story right now. Hey, it's priced exactly where it's supposed to be. If anything, the futures market at almost $51, as we're speaking on Wednesday afternoon, is maybe a little over what you think the yield curve is telling you fair value should be. I don't want to talk about right now. I want to talk about based on your projections of what's going to happen with the fall off in production and what you expect the impact of that to be on comparative inventory. What's your guess for where we go? What do you think the highest print is on WTI in terms of price before 2021 is out?
So the answer to your question is I think it easily could be $65. Now, that's a guess, obviously, but it's based on analogy. And if you look in slide three at the red circles, those are the past price excursions from the yield curve. And again, the yield curve is not meant to be some sort of an arithmetic regression. It's a fit, and it's fitting a lot of human behavior in there. So if you want to criticize it, you know, go ahead, but just understand what it is. But if you go look at those three ovals in the right-hand side of the curve, I mean, those are in the last few years. Those excursions were up to 30%. From the yield curve mean. So if we are at, let's just say 50, 30% of 50 is, 30% deviation is going to be $65 easily, right? And we've seen that. We saw going up to the blue yield curve, and you'll see above it in the white area, it says April, October 2018, Iran sanction optimism. We deviated off that blue yield curve, clear up into the red yield curve, all based on anticipation of lost supply. That's what the market does when it fears that there will be inadequate supply in the future. It raises price today so that people get their butts out there and start drilling wells to cover the supply crunch down the road, whenever that is, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months. So that's what I think.
And that's exactly the scenario that I'm expecting, Art. I think what happens as we get toward the end of 2021 is you get to a scenario where that rig count, I'm sure, will be higher than 230 or whatever it is now, but it won't be 900 or 1,000 or certainly not 1,800, whatever it was at the high. And I think at some point when people say, wait a minute, what do you mean the Cushing, Oklahoma is almost empty again? You know, we had this big crisis where we didn't have enough storage capacity. Now we don't have any oil to put in the tank. Nobody thought that was coming so quickly. And I predict that the crisis is not over yet. We're still in the pandemic, but everybody knows by then, okay, we're getting much more stability around these vaccines. Within another year or so, it really is going to be over. And then where's the rig count going to come from? And that's where if you get people panicking and saying, wait a minute, we can't recover, then the price can be emotionally driven to a significant deviation away from the yield curve. And I'm thinking toward the end of 21, maybe into the beginning of 22, is about where that deviation happens. And it's the combination of a brighter light at the end of the tunnel than we have now. If we're not dealing with all these mutations and other things, but it really does look like the vaccine situation is fully in hand. And we've got comparative inventory showing us not that we're running out of storage, but rather we're running out of oil to put in those big empty storage tanks. I think that's where people start to panic. Would you agree?
I would agree, Eric. And I'd add back into where we started this conversation. You know, you were talking about all of the ESG motivated shift from oil to, you know, other more sort of soft subjects, and we're kind of done with oil. I think this is going to be a big wake-up call, and I don't say this as an oil partisan by any means. It's just I think that the world and investors are so completely ignorant of the fact that the economy runs on oil, and they honestly believe they don't need oil. I mean, what kind of critical thinking goes into that? And again, that's, you know, you don't have to like oil. You can hate it, but that is the reality. It is the productivity, the multiplier effect that you get from a barrel of oil that makes economic growth possible. And right now, because things are so depressed and everybody's so bummed out and the economy's down, everybody's thinking, well, you know, I guess we don't really need it all that much. Wait until economic growth hits the skids, and you'll see that long before when people start freaking out about, well, where's the oil coming from? We cannot grow an economy without oil. Not today, not in the near future. Maybe we'll figure out how to do it sometime. We are nowhere near that. And if oil doesn't come back into vogue for oil investing for purely opportunistic reasons, then I guess I don't understand human nature, because you can make money.
Well, I think the key to that, Art, is oil production does continue to move out of vogue in the sense that people don't want to invest in it. It's not the cool thing to do anymore. It's not ESG friendly. It's all these things are wrong with it. So you do have capital drying up. But at the same time, you still need oil in order to run the economy. And what that does is maybe it hurts the bottom line of the producers, the companies in the oil industry. But in terms of the price of oil, it goes up, not down.
And when the price of oil goes up, the share price of the companies goes up. And when the share price of the company starts going up, investors say, wow, we could make some money. I mean, you know, I refuse to believe that people put as much money into the oil and gas business in 2016, 17, and 18 because they thought oil was a really lovely thing. They did it because they could make money. That oil share price gave them a multiplier on WTI, and they're not stupid if that opportunity presents itself again, particularly in a zero interest rate world. You don't think people are going to do it? I mean, I think if they don't, then they absolutely defy my understanding of human nature.
Speaking of making money, for people who want to make money trading this stuff, you offer some services at artberman.com. Tell us real quickly, we're already over time, but give us the quick rundown on what they can find there.
Yeah, I offer monthly subscriptions to my read and all the data on the oil inventory report and comparative inventory. I do the same for gas. I've got a monthly newsletter and I do a weekly rig count kind of thing. They're all pretty inexpensive. And if you want to know the details, just the facts, you want to know my interpretation, it doesn't cost you very much. Go to artberman.com and sign up. If you want the free pass, just see me on at AEBerman12 on Twitter. And if you can understand it all between all the apples people throw at me, most of the data's there too.
Well, Art, I can't thank you enough for another terrific interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back right after this message from our sponsor. The Fed has committed to keeping interest rates low for the foreseeable future. That means bond yields, already at record lows, will continue to stay near 0%. So where should you put your hard-earned income? Well, according to a new report from City Private Bank, contemporary art returned 13.6% per year over the last 25 years, compared to only 8.9% for the S&P 500. Contemporary art also has a lower loss ratio than gold, with almost no correlation to the stock market. Masterworks.io is the first and only platform that lets you invest in blue-chip art from artists like Monet and Picasso. Recently, Masterworks.io sold their first Banksy masterpiece for a 32% return net of fees to investors. To learn more, head to Masterworks.io today. See important information at Masterworks.io/disclaimer.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have an update from Art. It's always good to have him on the show. But did your bigger view of oil change in any way after that interview?
It didn't really change. What it did for me was it gave me an update on the timing. I wasn't sure when the price was really likely to make its final move higher, and it sounds like it's not till sometime in the second half of the year. I wasn't really sure when this was all going to kick in. What I think is very interesting is originally I thought it was going to be the decline in production that Art is talking about that was going to get us back up to $50. Well, we're already at $50 just on inflation pressures and other things going on in the market without even, you know, thinking about a decline in U.S. production. When that decline in U.S. production kicks in, I think that it could really accelerate the pace. Now, of course, if demand is collapsing because the entire economy is shut down after a massive new wave of the virus, well, you know, that changes things. But short of that, it seems to me like we're set up for that $75 print before the year is out. In any event, Patrick, let's move on to our post-game chart book. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you're not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage and look for the red button above Art Berman's picture that says Looking for the Downloads. Patrick, can 2021 get crazier than 2020? I say yes.
Eric, it is definitely a crazy start to the year, and we got full momentum in so many of the kind of bubblish stocks. I want to start off here on page two, just the S&P 500, which doesn't really feel too much like a bubble. I mean, it's slowly crawling higher, but I don't think it's the major components of the S&P 500 that are taking so much of the money flow. But with this breakout on the S&P 500 to a higher high, I mean, the most immediate coming week or two could see us finishing off moves towards even 4,000 on the upside. Certainly, we are long overdue for some sort of a consolidation or correction of this huge rally that's happened since March. But it's probably on the short term likely to first go a little bit higher before we start looking for the next kind of swing high in this market. But what I want to really touch on is taking a look under the hood for what the difference stocks or sectors within the markets are actually doing. And what I've continued to find fascinating is on page three that we have finally seen a true rotation and outperformance of the Russell small caps over that of the NASDAQ technology. And maybe the rising yields is playing into that as we are seeing a bit of that rotation and the cyclicals doing very well. But really a trend that's been in place very much so over the last three plus years has been that NASDAQ and technology outperformance. And it really seems now that you can find a lot of that performance in a much broader base of securities outside of those darling tech names that have truly been the rock stars over the last year or two. But what's also interesting is looking at what are the bubble stocks in page four. And what's amazing is that, you know, we have Tesla here approaching $800, making Elon Musk the richest man in the world and making Tesla, if I did the math right, have a market cap greater than the next 11 largest car companies combined. We really have this froth in parabolic rise, but you can see in orange when we're looking at that Tesla, really Bitcoin has been playing catch up in terms of percentage gains on the upside. Both of them now approaching 600% off of their March lows. And so it's going to be really interesting to see who wins this race for ultimately where we see some sort of a short to intermediate high. But certainly Bitcoin at this moment has really gained the accelerated parabolic rise element that may actually shoot it past Tesla. It'll be really interesting to see.
Yeah, to me, it's very interesting to see that the biggest performing names anywhere in finance are both things which, frankly, I respect the prerogative of other people who have different opinions, but at least some of us hold the opinion that neither one of them has any value whatsoever. And, you know, clearly the momentum is there. The story is there. People love the story behind both of them. Whether or not it really makes sense for Tesla to be worth more than car manufacturers that actually manufacture lots of cars, all of them combined, it just blows my mind. In any event, let's move on to the U.S. dollar. We're coming back down into that key support zone where, boy, if that doesn't hold, look out below.
Well, sure. But, you know, I think that at minimum, the first go around, we're going to find support along those lows. I mean, there might be a much bigger picture trend in play that will see the dollar index still break lower. But a number of these little measured moves are coming into this key support line. But the interesting part is I'm using the commitment of traders reports, the commercial dealers versus speculators. And I know that in the currency markets, that it's a little trickier to use COT reports. But it kind of gives a bigger idea of the sentiment, which is that generally everyone is quite bearish the dollar here. And while that in itself doesn't give a fundamental catalyst for a turn, it certainly offers a liquidity-driven short squeeze potential that once we reach this support, if there's any reversal in this, a short squeeze could quickly drive a counter trend, a very sharp counter trend move that may have no fundamental backing behind it. And so it'll be really interesting to see along the support line in the coming weeks, whether or not it holds and a reversal emerges off of here.
Moving on to page six, Patrick, boy, look at that. We're above the $50 line on crude oil. And that's where we were exactly at $50 on February 1st when, well, Macro Voices listeners knew that a global pandemic was coming because we told you on January 30th. But most of the world wasn't paying attention yet, certainly wasn't being priced into markets. We're above that number now.
Oh, that's for sure. And, you know, the one thing that I'm going to be watching in the next week is whether or not this is a false start. Now, I don't necessarily want to make that call today, but if we found ourselves quickly back below $48 in the coming week, then I would consider that to be at least where we could run out of some short-term momentum. But that would have to be only after the fact. With a breakout like this, typically what you would see is the follow-through target those previous highs. And so barring some immediate reversal, which would have to happen in the next couple of trading sessions, I think oil following through toward those December and February highs up along that 54 to 56 range are entirely on the table here. But moving on, though, what I wanted to really talk about was some of these other commodities, and particularly that kind of parabolic rises that we're seeing in Bitcoin and in Tesla are not alone in their in that EV space and in the crypto space. What's amazing is that while copper is breaking to higher highs, we're really seeing, if we go to page 8, some true parabolic rises developing in the copper miners. And we're seeing just some of these parabolic rises in everything from Freeport, McMoRan to Southern Copper or Ivanhoe Mines or any of these other plays that are just running to the upside. And it'll be really interesting to see whether or not all of these markets reach their short-term swing high peaks in a similar window of time. It's funny that it's all happening at the same time, but another example of that is on page 9, that North Shore Uranium Mining ETF. See the miners just starting to really run on the upside. Just it seems to be that there's this big acceleration in so many commodities, ag stocks, everything from the beans to corn and all the other types of commodities are just running on the upside. And it's really feeding that inflation or reflation narrative, at least it has been for the last month or so.
Well, I don't know. You could look at that the other way and say this entire move up on URNM is because they chose to advertise on Macrovices in the fourth quarter and drove the entire market for uranium higher. I'm sure that was it.
I'm sure it was.
No, I think it actually had something to do with the United States government declaring a strategic uranium reserve in addition to the strategic petroleum reserve. Let's move on to government bonds on page 10.
Right. And this is just where I wanted to just touch on the fact that we had a considerable overhead resistance at the 1% yield level on the 10-year Treasury bond. And at the start of this year, we had a clear breakout of it. We're now trading at 1.08% on the upside. But what's particularly interesting is that it was an outright breakout on a whole number of the steepener trades. I particularly highlighted the 2s-10s, which we had an inverted curve for a little while back in August of 2019. And we now are clearly seeing this new uptrend emergent on this. And that's whether you're looking at the 5s-30s or any of the other ones. Obviously, this is all a bear steepening based upon inflation expectations rising, which I think the commodity rally is obviously playing a key precipitating role in driving that. But that's where on page 12, we can really see that breakout on inflation expectations. This ProShares ETF that I have here is anchored off of the 30-year break-evens. And so you have a clear breakout happening here. And it'll be really interesting to see with a breakout like this, how far does it go? I mean, are we going to see now finally Treasury bonds and yields pressing back into those ranges? Like, if, for instance, using crude oil as an example, crude oil is almost back to its highs from the start of the year in the pre-COVID period, and yet yields have not gotten nowhere near their highs, which were somewhere just a stone's throw away from 2% back then. I mean, are we about to see the yields get to like 1.5%+ on this impulse? It'll be really interesting because those bonds have been quite boring, and there's been a lot of bond bears waiting for this break, and so it'll be really interesting to see if in the coming weeks this continues to follow through.
Well, and of course, we have interviewed some very, very smart people like Mike Green and Dr. Lacey Hunt, who still see deflation as the name of the day. But boy, as I look at charts like this, I really think inflation and certainly commodities are the place to be. I want to make sure before we close, Patrick, that we hook our listeners up with the webinar that you did over the holidays that was about trading the commodity cycle. If they missed it, can we still get it on the website? And if so, where do we find it?
Right. So we did over the holidays that tactically trading the commodity cycle webinar, and the recording is still available in the member section. So if you didn't have a chance to sign up and watch it and are still interested in watching it, the recording is on the site. You just have to sign up for a free trial at bigpicturetrading.com.
We're going to leave it there for today's episode. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Masterworks.io, bringing fine art investing within reach of all investors. Patrick, what can they expect to find in this week's research roundup?
Well, this week you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to Art's slide deck and the chart book we just discussed in the postgame. There's also a GMO article on waiting for the last dance and a link to the variant perception article comparing today's markets with 2009 and 2017. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, that's Eric spelled with a K, and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com. the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.